Penguin Random House Audio presents In Memory of Bread by Paul Graham. Read for you by MacLeod Andrews. I think it could be plausibly argued that changes of diet are more important than changes of dynasty or even of religion. George Orwell, The Road to Wigan Pier. Introduction. When I was 36, I suddenly became a drastically different kind of eater. A genetic predisposition caused my immune system to stop responding to wheat and other glutinous grains as it always had. Instead of sustenance, they were poisons. For a while, I did not perceive any difference. Then, severe illness jolted me out of my routine. When I recovered, I found myself in a strange place. It was as if a sinkhole had opened beneath an important part of my life and irretrievably consumed it. I had been an avid home cook and amateur beer brewer. These were the leisure activities that helped me define my place in the world, the things that I enjoyed most with my wife and close friends. Overnight, I ceased to be someone who could enjoy bread, pizza, beer, and many other foods of cultural and personal importance, at least in the ways I had always experienced them. In a sense, I was no longer the same person. I was like an amateur athlete who tears up her knee and will never be the same runner, or an equestrian who develops an allergy to horses, or a proud homeowner sickened by some substance in his house. I was not, thankfully, making my living in food, but I had long equated good food with good living. Few, if any, human activities are as natural and habitual as eating. In fact, it is precisely because cooking and eating food are essential to our survival that we lose sight of how much of our identity we express at the table. We sit down 3 times a day, if we are fortunate, to eat what tastes good to us, what we can afford, and what we were taught to cook. Our meals focus on satiety, or so it seems. But the core of who we are, where we came from, and what we believe is often, if not always, on the plate in some way, whether dinner came out of the freezer section or the garden. The changes in my daily routine were predictable, but I could not have anticipated the social or emotional changes, nor the differences in how I would relate to both my own past and, more broadly, human history. And I did not foresee my resilience, or the way longing, the poor cousin of necessity, can be a path to inspiration. Eventually, I did learn these things. Changing how I cooked and ate altered how I saw myself in the world. And so, once again, the table seemed almost, if not completely, full. Chapter 1. Last Meals. A winter several years ago will forever be the time when I discovered the intense yet simple pleasures of great homemade bread. As with most transformative experiences, the timing was everything. My wife started baking in January after one of our friends introduced her to artisan bread in 5 minutes a day. Its basic recipe, as artisan devotees know, makes baking bread with a chewy crumb and shattering crust tantalizingly easy. You mix up a mess of dough, let it age in the fridge, and pull out handfuls to shape, let rise, and bake whenever the urge for a fresh loaf strikes. I often stepped inside, from walking the dog or carrying firewood, leaving behind a blanched sky and snow that literally blew sideways, to hot bread waiting on the wire rack. The windows were steamed over, the whole house bloomed with heat. What I felt was beyond anticipation or joy. It was a sense of wealth and gratitude that humans have known for a long, long time. I couldn't have contrived this feeling if I tried, and it had everything to do with the smell and taste of baked grains against northern New York's cold, sparse background. As she explored the cookbook, Beck made whole wheat loaves, white loaves, cheddar cheese bread, dinner rolls, cinnamon buns, and my favorite, limpa, a Swedish rye seasoned with orange peel, star anise, cumin, and sugar. At first, she baked 1 or 2 a week. I tore off chunks while they still steamed from the oven. In the afternoons, I made a cup of tea with toast and chose a jar from the vault, a hutch in our dining room stacked with homemade preserves like brandied melon jam and crabapple jelly. Every summer and into the fall, Beck puts up seasonal fruits and vegetables she gets from the market and our farm share, and, in the case of the crabapples anyway, that we forage on the college campus where I teach English. By most estimates, you only have a year or two to eat that stuff. I was doing my part in the race against spoilage. Sometimes I ate a loaf in a day. Once or twice, I may have eaten almost 2 loaves in a day. Most of ours, and then most of our friends, when we went over to their place for dinner, where the talk, which always turned to food, inevitably gravitated to our helplessness around this bread. Geography was a factor in our raptures. We live in a rural place, and at the time, the sole good nearby bakery was attached to our local food co-op. We had been enjoying the co-op's loaves for years, but the artisan bread was even better and more fun. We loved the ingenious substitution for the steam jets in professional ovens, which involved pouring a cup of boiling water into a preheated sauté pan, creating a dramatic hiss. When we took the bread out and it hit the cooler air, we bent close to the counter and listened as the crust tightened with a series of crackles. But most of all, we loved the sweet, comforting smell of bread baking away as the temperature dropped and we turned local root vegetables into soups and stews. If we and our friends were conscious of the symbolism of breaking bread at these meals, nobody ever mentioned it. And yet, I think if you'd asked any of us whether the experience would have been diminished without my friend David's triumphant soda bread, or without my friends Sarah and Mayer's perfect airy white loaves, or without whatever 50 times better than supermarket bread anyone else had made, we would have said, "Yes, of course." Now I know that to be the truth. You can have fellowship over any meal, but sharing bread seems to deliver an especially high emotional return for a simple food. Bread has always inspired such excitement, even reverence, in those who have so much as stood near a fresh loaf. In those days, I had no reason to feel guilty or wary about my bread consumption. I did not obsess over calories or carbs, preferring to believe that if you're eating good food, whole food, and frequently moving your body, the math all works out in the end. I'll immediately add, however, that until genetics came calling, I had been one of those annoying types who never had to think about what they ate, or did not eat. In retrospect, I see that I was consuming a ton of gluten. But I didn't know then that gluten could be a problem for me. I didn't think that gluten could be a problem for anyone, actually. Until one day when I heard someone, a student of mine or a colleague, mention her dietary restrictions. I registered this person's pain distantly. As a friend would later say to me, "All I know is that I'm glad I don't have what you've got." I certainly did not yet understand that those who cannot tolerate wheat struggle against a tradition so long and so deep that some anthropologists believe that by now the desire for grain in general, and bread in particular, is all but hardwired into people of European and Middle Eastern ancestry. Beck registered the staggering speed at which I was consuming her bread. It took her time to make, she said, and it'd be nice if now and then a loaf could hang around the house longer than a day and a half. In response, I might have pointed out that ancient Egyptian temple officials, instead of being paid in cash, received a share of 900 fine wheat breads, 36,000 flatbreads roasted in coals, and 900 jugs of beer per year, if the archaeological records are to be believed. That's 3,000 flatbreads a month, and you haven't even drunk the beer yet. Surely these officials were feeding their huge families, servants, and slaves, but they still had a few flatbreads left over for themselves. Against such impressive consumption, my own looked modest, even pitiful. Speaking of 900 jugs of beer, at about the same time as the artisan bread discoveries, my friend David and I began brewing beer. In this way, our homes were not unlike those of the ancients, who baked their bread and brewed their beer in adjacent rooms, often using the yeast in the beer scum, known in some places as barm, to inoculate their bread dough. That's not how our beer project came about, though.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?